Thank you. Our current bylaws were a noble plan, and we all had great hope 17 years ago that they'd work, but they've been a colossal failure. We have dysfunctional local station boards and a dysfunctional national board, which drive Millway major donors. We have millions of dollars of debt, millions increasing every year with no repayment plan. Please go to rethinkingpacifica.org for more details and to learn why it's so critical for you to vote yes for the new bylaws in order to save KPFT and all of our stations. Again, that's rethinkingpacifica.org. I want to remind everybody, if you've already voted, you can change your vote, but you need today as the deadline to request a new ballot for that. Go to our frequently asked questions on our website for more details, but please vote yes to support bylaws reform. Help us save KPFT. Help us save all of our stations. Help us save our building. Pacifica has a great future. Thank you.
Thank you. Ted and Dwayne, you have 1 minute.
PacificaFightBack.org. PacificaFightBack.org. Get the facts. These proposals are cooked up by elitists of the foundation to have a privileged few to determine the survival of the foundation. Some of the leaders of this group have supported filing bankruptcy and other things, as I've stated earlier. These same people have been on off the board for the last 15 years or more. Thus, they cause the very problems and issues they complain about today. Again, these same leaders have been part of the majority or in the majority faction who have created the mess and the dysfunction now. They claim they will correct it with this new hand-picked board they have selected in their secret closed meetings. Should we trust their judgment in the face of the non-inclusive behavior displayed to produce these proposed bylaws? They propose a limited representative body that they handpicked in secret, which is anti-democratic and elitist. To put it mildly, fight back, PacificaFightBack.org. PacificaFightBack.org.
10 seconds.
PacificaFightBack.org. Again, I repeat, PacificaFightBack.org.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank Bill Crozier from the proponents and Ted Weisgal and Dwayne Lark for participating in the Pacifica Bylaws Referendum 2020 on KPFT Radio. Also want to thank KPFT for technically assisting this and remind everyone to cast your ballot before March 19th, 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time. Please visit elections.pacifica.org for all questions and to file a ballot request form if you have not received your ballot. If you do not have access to the Internet, call 510-931-7504 to leave me a message. Please note that all viewpoints expressed on both sides are those of the participants and do not reflect the position of the Pacifica Foundation or any of its radio stations. Thank you very much. That's a wrap.
Thank you.
Of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees, Signals, 8 p.m. Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host tonight, Mary Edgerton, and I work on So What's Your Story with an ensemble of gifted hosts. Hank Rubicek, our producer and the show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. Not to mention our extended family of guest hosts, Eric Heen, Harwood Taylor, and Christy Gorman. Our team goes beyond hosts and storytellers. Yes, we do need a production engineer and media director, and that is Justin O'Neill, whom you will hear from later on in the hour. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the magic and the power of storytelling. Whenever magic is in the air, you can expect the unexpected. This is March, traditionally the month of March Madness, so definitely expect the unexpected. And we, as a community, are dealing with the unexpected. As COVID-19 has taken over the agenda from March, I have chosen a set of stories to take you out of that realm. Our stories tonight are going to take you on unexpected adventures, unexpected things your mothers might do or say, unexpected changes in life, and so much more. Oh, the places we will go. So first, expect the unexpected. There has been a slight change in the guest roster from the show. Tonight I have Sharon Dorsey. Sharon, an environmental engineer, has been on the show with us before with a delightful set of stories about her father, a pragmatic eccentric, so to speak. Sharon is also a frequent storyteller at The Moth and a Moth Story Slam winner. We also have Mohani Zubidi, who is on our show for the first time. Mohani is also a Houston Moth storyteller. She hails from Austin, where she started a group called Story Sisters, and we will hear a little more about that later. Well, tonight we're going to start with Sharon. So, Sharon, what does the month of March mean to you?
Well, Mary, the first thing that comes to my mind when I'm asked, what do I think of for the month of March? It is the word snowbound. Snowbound is my word for March.
And you have to know that snowbound is not a word we hear very often in Houston.
Yes. Well, and I will tell you my story because it's a Pennsylvania story. A Pennsylvania story from my youth. But and let me start by saying many years ago, this memory of being snowbound caused me to look up John Greenleaf Whittier's poem called Snowbound. It's an idyll, and it was written in 1866. Now, he was an interesting man himself. He was a Quaker and an abolitionist. It turns out that this is one of my favorite poems, Snowbound. And so to start, I'm just going to read you a few lines from near the beginning of the poem. And when the second morning shone, we looked upon a world unknown, on nothing we could call our own. Around the glittering wonder bent the blue walls of the firmament, no cloud above, no earth below. A universe of sky and snow. The old familiar sights of ours took marvelous shapes, strange domes and towers. Well, that's what I think of when I think of March, and I think of the word snowbound. And snowbound means that you're snowed in and you can't go anywhere. You can't leave the house. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and it seemed that every other year, we would have a heavy snow in the month of March. Now, heavy was the operative word. The snowfall total would be at least 3 feet, and the snow, being a spring snow, was wet and sticky. And, of course, everything shut down until the plows could nibble their way through the streets. But what made Snowbound being so exciting for us kids was that the heavy, wet snow would bring down the power lines and the telephone lines, and we were isolated. Now, my family wasn't really isolated. We lived in a subdivision, and there were other houses all around us with a major north-south highway about a mile away. And we were about 90 miles west of Philadelphia and about 90 miles north of Washington, D.C., so clearly we were not in the forest primeval. But when I was about 10 years old, and my little brother Frankie was about 6 years old, we thought we were living like Little House on the Prairie when we were snowbound. My family had a gas stove, which still worked because you only had to light a burner with a match. The neighbors had electric stoves, So when they could clear a path to our house, they would come over to heat coffee and soup. But none of the furnaces worked because there was no electricity. We prepared for these big spring storms like people prepare for a hurricane. We had candles and matches and potato chips and peanut butter and jelly and bread and milk. And we had a supply of firewood. Our house did have a fireplace. So when Dad bought supplies, he made sure we had the fixings for s'mores. Graham crackers, chocolate bars, and marshmallows. But we didn't use our fireplace except when we were snowbound. My mother did not like the fine dust that settled on her furniture. She would have to clean that. And she hated cleaning the ashes out of the fireplace. So most of the time, our fireplace held big candles or fake plants. During the daytime, we would sit by the fire wrapped in blankets and play card games or board games. We would have our little transistor radio on to hear the weather report and the news about road openings and where power was being restored. But we would only listen for 30 minutes at a time to conserve the batteries. Dad would impress upon us that we were having an emergency and we were in conservation mode. My dad, who was a funny character, would periodically narrate our own situation to us. Like before he turned on the radio, he would say something like, "Reporting from the D'Orsay house, we have Sharon and Frankie sitting by the fire snacking on cookies. Oh no, Frankie just ate the last Fig Newton. Will this family have enough food to last through this snow emergency?" And of course, Frankie and I would look at each other wide-eyed, and Frankie would spit out the cookie to save it for later. As kids, we had no idea that inevitably power would be restored within 24 to 48 hours. We did not go outside and play because we didn't have any way to dry the wet clothes. Except Dad would go outside to shovel a small space for our little dog to do her business. This step was necessary because the snow was 36 inches high and the dog was about 10 inches high. Bedtime was the very best because then Frankie and I knew we were survivalists. Mom would heat water on the gas stove and fill up a hot water bottle for each of us and wrap a towel around it to take under the covers. Then Mom and Dad would put extra blankets on our beds and then spread out our winter coats over the blankets and tuck us in. And only our noses were peeking out of the pile of bed covers. But come morning, no one wanted to be the first one up. Even though nature called, no one wanted to be the first one to sit on the very cold toilet seat. One snowbound incident stays glued in my memory. One morning, it was the second or third day of being snowbound. Of course, as kids, we didn't know realistically power would be restored soon and we would be back to normal in the near future. We were sitting at the breakfast table with our frosted flakes in our bowls, waiting for Dad to pour on the milk. He was narrating again. Mom rolled her eyes because she was really tired of having Dad, Frankie, and I underfoot. Dad took the lid off the milk and said, "Here we have the D'Orsay family hunkered down, waiting for power, in the aftermath of this heavy storm. Sharon and Frankie will soon have cereal." And he started waving the milk container around, and voila! As you would expect, it flew from his hand and landed on the kitchen floor, spilling every drop. All four of us stared at the mess. Mom and Dad jumped into action, getting towels to soak up the milk. Frankie started to cry, spitting out between sobs, "We're all gonna die. starve because we lost our milk. And Mom was yelling at Dad, idiot, now we have a pile of towels that will shortly smell sour, and I cannot wash them because we have no power. And Dad is still narrating, assuring us that the D'Orsay family will make it through the milk crisis. Apparently, Mom was on her last nerve. She probably could have used the lemon drop martini, but it was only 8 a.m. The aftermath is that Mom decided it was time for Dad to start shoveling the path from the front door and start shoveling the driveway. She booted him out of the door with instructions, "Don't come back in before it is absolutely necessary." Then she glared at Frankie and me, communicating with her eyes that one false move and we were toast. She hoarsely whispered, "I do not want to hear a peep out of either one of you. Eat your cereal dry and pretend that you are real pioneers." And she spun around and fled to her room where she put herself into timeout, slamming the door. Well, Frankie and I stared at our cereal bowls and started eating. But the dry cereal wouldn't stay on the spoon. So we pretended we were pioneer ponies eating out of our trough, and we put our faces right into the bowl. "Hey, this isn't so bad," I said. "At least it has sugar on it." And Frankie just looked up from his bowl and said, winnowing like a horse.
That is such a great story. I mean, if that's not March Madness, that's March Madness squared. Okay. I love the winnowing part. Actually, I think I love every part. I also love the mom part of everybody disappear. I am going into timeout.
It's true.
I can understand it so well. That was a great adventure. That was a fun adventure. And I lived in Pennsylvania. I remember those snows. Okay. How about another adventure? We need it. It's March Madness.
Okay. I have another adventure. You know, as I tell my stories at the Moth or on What's Your Story, these are stories about my family, which for the most part, I've come to realize was pretty eccentric. And so this is a story about my mother, who came to live with me for the last 16 years of her life. I took her on many adventures with me, and on every one, she did something unexpected and surprising right up to her last breath.
Okay, as a woman over 60, I have to say, it's so delightful to have your edit button not work anymore.
Isn't that true? And apparently this must have been a story that tickled a lot of people, because this is the story that allowed me to win first place at the Moth in January.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, and I was trying to win that prize for a couple of years.
Oh, yes, and I've heard your stories, and you should have won many times over. But take us away on this adventure.
Okay, here's an adventure and a surprise. Very quickly after Dad's death, my mom moved in with me. Two single ladies separated by 23 years, but joined by 23 chromosomes and at least 23,000 memories. It was then that adventures and new learnings began for my mom. A few words to understand my mom. She was smart, kind, resourceful, feisty, and a real trooper, in the words of Dad. She was also petite, about the size of a chickadee. Living with me, she quickly made eating in fine new restaurants her favorite adventure. Invariably, a fine restaurant demanded two lemon drop martinis, crab cake appetizer, an entree, and cream brulee. Although I was working, when I wanted to do something, I took Mom along with me, saying, "Pick out your clothes for an adventure." She was always ready for fun, especially because she neither planned nor paid. But invariably, she would exhibit some kind of unexpected behavior, a surprise to me that provided a list of things not to do. For example, when as a guest at an authentic 1880s Thanksgiving dinner in Plymouth, Massachusetts, my mom is the one who asked if her apple cider could be switched for a lemon drop martini. When we took our first of many dog sledding trips along the Canadian border, the snow was over the knees off the trail. When we stopped to rest the dogs, Mom waddled into the woods to pee, but ignored the advice of holding onto a tree branch while she did this. This failure naturally resulted in her falling backwards, and with her ass freezing and her feet tangled up in her snow pants, she had to get our guide, Pierre, to help her stand back up. Once I took her to view an earlier rendition of the Vagina Monologues in Portland. She really enjoyed it, and she kept nudging the stranger sitting next to her, a woman we did not know. Finally, she leaned over to the woman, and with a very loud whisper, she bursts out, "I know all the nicknames for vagina. Let me know if you need anything explained. My husband was a sailor." My last example is that I took her to a fancy spa in Reykjavik for her February birthday. My mom did not pay close attention to her surroundings, nor does my mom follow directions. She exited the wrong door and ended up locked out of the spa, standing in the lobby of the hotel, wearing only a small towel while everyone else was in parkas. Of course, she did not speak Icelandic. Well, I think all things come to an end, and eventually dementia ruined our adventure-filled life. I became her caregiver for the last 6 years leading to her death. And on the morning she died, I sat by her bed holding her hand when the hospice nurse said, "She is ready to go. Tell your mom it's okay." I told Mom, "Mom, your work on earth is finished. You may go to heaven now." But nothing happened. So I tried again. "Mom, do you know what St. Peter has waiting for you in heaven? A lemon drop martini, crab cakes, and cream brulee." And she stopped breathing and slipped away. "My goodness," said the hospice nurse, "I have never seen that before." I shook my head and said, "I could not accompany her on this adventure, but I sure hope that St. Peter remembered to go to Specs and Kroger's this week, or I will have hell to pay."
That is so perfect. That's the way I want to go. I have to make sure my children hear this show. In fact, one of my stepsons said to me, because he's going to have, what, his biological mother, his stepmother, me, his father, and the third wife, okay, that's like, what, one, two, three of us to take care of. And he says, "You're going to be the easiest. We're just going to put you in a rocking chair, point you in the direction of the sun, and put a glass of wine in your hand. And you'll be fine. The others, there will be problems."
There'll be some challenges.
There will be some challenges. Yes, yes. Ah, that was delightful. Now, speaking of mothers, Mahani, I understand that your mother was, I don't know, prone to unexpected behaviors.
Well, I think by the time we were teenagers, we could see that her behavior might be unexpected. But when we were kids, she was just being mom.
So tell us about that.
Well, my mother is the queen of emotional blackmail.
I love it.
It is nuanced today, but when I was a kid, you love me? You love me or not? If you love me, you'll wash the dishes. She loved telling us stories of what happens to kids who don't love their mothers. For one young man, the earth split open. He fell right through, straight to hell. Another girl was turned into stone. My mother's all-time favorite was the story of Split Rock, the rock that swallows mothers. Once, at the edge of a forest, lived a single mom with two kids. Every day, she did back-breaking work to support herself and her children, gathering firewood, harvesting wild fruits, setting traps in the river. One morning, she found a large fish. She was so happy, she ran home, fried the fish, cooked some rice, and told the kids, "Leave some for me," and went back to work in the forest. When she returned, there was nothing left. The kids ate everything. The mother was brokenhearted. She could not take it anymore. She ran into the forest and called, "Split Rock!" And Split Rock split open and swallowed her. And her children never saw her again. Well, my mother got a lot of mileage out of that story. Months of mileage. Remember Split Rock? Remember the story? Stop fighting. Clean your room or I'll call Split Rock. One afternoon, my mother was folding laundry. My mother did laundry every day for four kids, my dad and her. She sat on a low stool on our bathroom floor with a bar of soap and a scrub. It was back-breaking work. She rinsed the water, hanged the clothes outside in the sun, and when they were dry, a mountain of laundry on her bed. She folded them and laid them in stacks for each one of us. And now she's asking for our help. Pick up your clothes. Pick up your clothes or I'll call Split Rock. My two brothers, my sister and I, were busy brawling. We would tangle like a giant ball crashing through the living room, laughing when we got hit, crying when we got hit. Two will hold one down while the other farts in the face. My brothers loved that. My sister and I tried it, but it wasn't our thing. Split Rock Schmidt Sprock. We'd heard that story so many times. It had worn off. When suddenly we heard, "Split Rock, Split Rock, swallowing rock, swallow me, my children don't love me, swallow me, they don't care for me, Split Rock, take me." Dang, this is some real shit now. She had never gone to that level. I love my mother. I don't want her to go away. Please, God, don't let anything bad happen to my mother. We got our stacks, put them in our cubicles, and that was the first and last time she sang to Split Rock. I cannot remember if she told us any more stories about children who don't love their mothers. Once in a while, when she can't take it anymore, she still straight up asks my siblings and I, even today, "Do you love me?" To my youngest brother, if you love me, you will find a wife. He is 50 and still single. So I see you married before I close my eyes. And for all of us, if all of you love me, you will pray. You will pray so we can meet in heaven. Don't you understand? We will not meet if you all don't pray. I will be on one side and y'all will be on the other. And my sister would say, well, we will wave at you. And don't forget to wave back. She will say, it's not funny, but she laughs.
I have to say, it reminds me a little bit about my children who had a great distaste for going to church and anything having to do with church. And I would try everything. I would do that 1, 2, 3. It's going to happen, blah, 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 blah. And finally, one day, I just sat down with my head in my hands and I said, okay, I'm done. I'm going to go to church and pray for you. Oh, my God. They jumped out of their seats and ran up. No, Mom, no, no, no. What is it you want us to do?
Did they go?
Yes.
You got them to go.
I got them to do what I had to do by threatening to go pray for them.
Okay.
Yeah. So that reminds me of your mother. Okay. So, yeah. Telling my kids that I was going to pray for them usually made them come round, and coming round tells me that the time is coming round to the half hour and time for station identification. So this is Mary Edgerton with storytellers Sharon Dorsey and Mohani Zabudi, and our wonderful producer Hank Rubichek, our engineer Justin O'Neill. We actually have Tatiana Gargo as a guest in the back. You are listening to us right here on So What's Your Story on Pacifica KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, or live streaming at kpft.org. Justin, what's happening in the Houston in the storytelling world?
Well, Mary, let me begin with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it is a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30, and that is at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. Their next swap is scheduled for March 24th, and be sure to bring a friend. Visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about their upcoming events. Also, the Liars Contest will be held on Saturday, April 4th at Red Yards Pub, 6 to 8:30. You can also enjoy our past So What's Your Story programs listed on the menu under Radio Program Online. You don't want to miss any of our weekly live programs, and not owning a radio is never a problem because you can listen to us stream live at kpft.org and on Facebook. We're also on YouTube. We're all over the place. Get to know us by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and be sure to share it with friends. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave. Got program ideas, guests, maybe yourself? Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. Don't forget our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some terrific stories. Last Tuesday's theme was Challenge. Get your tickets online at themoth.org. They sometimes sell out. And for our listeners who want to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? And also, I want to turn it over to Hank so he can say a little bit more about the Liars Contest.
Thank you, Justin. You know, first of all, yeah, a challenge was this last Tuesday. The one coming up will be, I think it's April 4th, and it will be Earth. You know, Earth to Justin, Earth to Justin, Earth to Justin, Earth to Justin.
It's
I want
Earth
to say a little bit about
April.
The Liars Contest, because one of our tellers tonight, Sharon, who we love, is going to be one of the contestants. And nobody lies better than Sharon. And you just need to know that. You know, like, I was in this contest a few years ago. I came in third. I mean, okay, there were only three tellers. But nevertheless, Sharon is really good. So if you love her storytelling, and you've got to come listen to her. All of the information is on our site. It's at Rudyard's in Montrose. I can't talk price, but it is an expensive getting in. And you also need to know that these tellers will be getting cash prizes. Again, I can't talk amounts, but the first prize winner, Sharon's got a great chance at this, It looks like a dollar. If you move the decibel point, you'll get the better amount. Okay? So let me just leave it at that. In the meantime, that will be April 4th. As Mary knows, we have to keep a lookout on the incidents that are going on in our lives right now to make sure that that is going to be scheduled. But as of right now, it is a go. But as Justin pointed out, please check things out at www.HoustonStorytellers.org for all the essential information. And we hope to see you there that night at Rudyard's. I'm going to be the MC, and I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks, Mary. Back to you.
Hey, that was great. I am looking forward to that. Oh, my God. Guys, you're going to love Sharon's story. But speaking of Sharon's story, you know, let's talk about this. We've been talking about March, March Madness. Our lives have been upended by the COVID-19 crisis, so to speak. Our plot lines have lost their tracks. There have been twists and turns that we were not expecting in that O. Henry kind of way. Sharon, got a story about plots leaving the tracks, so to speak?
I do. And this was one of my first moth stories. And the theme was bamboozled. And sometimes your life just takes these twists and turns that, you know, just kind of knock you back. And my story is one of them. So you have to go back in time because the year is 1969. And in 1969, attitudes towards sex, sexuality, and gender were just starting to see daylight. 20-year-old me is in college. Women live in the dorms and have curfews. Men are not allowed above the dormitory lobby. And I'll tell you what our sexual visualization was at that time. Remember, this is 8 years before the founding of Victoria's Secret. And we thought we were just being so out there because we girls participated in panty raids. Now, this certainly dates me, but what that was during study week before finals, at a prearranged time, the boys would gather outside the girls' dormitory and yell, "Silk! Silk! Silk!" And in response, we girls would throw underpants out of the window. That was the extent of our sexual wildness. I was in summer school in Pittsburgh. I had a boyfriend who was working at his home in Cleveland, Ohio at the same time. I had arranged to take the Greyhound bus from Pittsburgh to Cleveland to see him. As I made myself comfortable in the bus terminal, I looked around the terminal to see what other people were doing. Directly across from me sat two adolescent girls. They had their heads together. Their heads were touching, and they were talking quietly, sometimes giggling. And they had the hands together, and their hands were moving, and it looked like they had some sort of little hand puzzle that was keeping them occupied. I began reading my novel, but soon was distracted by mumblings coming from across the aisle in the direction of the girls. I looked up and saw that a rather unkempt man had sat next to the girls, and he appeared to be muttering gibberish. For a moment, he flailed his arms, and then I watched him unzip his fly and remove his penis. "Holy crap," I said to myself, as I watched him hold it in one hand and stroke it with the other. Now, I was no stranger to male anatomy. I had a younger brother, Frankie, and Mom put us in the bathtub together much longer than she should have. Plus, at age 12, I had started babysitting for the princely sum of 50 cents per hour. I had changed scores of diapers of babies of both genders. I knew what I was looking at. What to do? I briefly thought of just moving seats, but I looked over at the two girls still involved in their game, and I knew I just could not leave. After all, was I not a Girl Scout? Hadn't I taken the pledge of the Legion of Decency at St. Joseph's Roman Catholic Church? I put down my novel and scampered to a security guard near the door, telling him of the offense. He jumped into action, and before I knew it, the two girls were whisked off to safety by a gentlewoman from Traveler's Aid, and two of Pittsburgh's finest men in blue were at the scene arresting the transgressor. One policeman got my contact information so I could testify as a witness when this case came before the judge, and I got on my bus to Cleveland. About 5 weeks later, the policeman called me and requested that I come to the county courthouse to report what I had observed. The policeman said that the district attorney was going to ask for no additional time in jail for the offender, since he had been in county lockup for over a month. That sounded good to me. Nevertheless, I was concerned about the two girls. What had they seen? What did they think? Were they traumatized? Were they okay? After all, they had sat next to this man during his flailing and sputtering and petting. So I asked the policeman, how were the girls? Fine, he said, shrugging his shoulder, no problem. I was confused. Well, I offered, did they need counseling? He looked at me oddly and then said, oh, didn't anyone tell you? The girls are students at the School for the Blind.
That is a plot twist.
And it goes to show that fact is stranger than fiction because it's a true story.
Yes, yes. Wow. That takes it off the rails. I just want to say for a moment, I said earlier that we would come back and talk about what the story sisters are. I want to say that we're sitting here. You can't see us, but we are three of us women of a certain age and very much into storytelling. I would say that we have had our flirtations with marriage and not. And I don't know, you had a great line about your first husband.
Oh, about how that worked out?
About how that worked out.
Well, yes, that was my first marriage when I was young, and that's when I had my biggest surprise ever. My biggest surprise.
It's March Madness.
We were married for about 6 years, and the entire time he was in professional training to earn a dental specialty degree. And one day, at the end of his training, he came home from the hospital and said, I want a divorce. I was completely caught off guard. I was totally bamboozled. I felt like I was hit by a 2x4. I didn't expect this. It just came out of the blue. Now, by that time, I had earned a master's degree and a PhD, and I had a fabulous high-paying job. I could even solve a differential equation without a computer. And I found that he left me for the departmental secretary who thought the bar exam had something to do with alcoholic beverages. how easily we are replaced.
Okay. And it seemed like we took you a little off rails there, but I wanted y'all to hear that, to know that we three had dinner together. We formed a sisterhood. And Mahani's going to tell us about her project in Austin called Story Sisters, about sisterhoods of storytelling. So excuse me for that little anecdotal introduction, but it was rich.
Love it.
Yeah.
Story Sisters, I started Story Sisters 3.5 years ago in Austin. So actually, January of 2016, I wrote a play called 60 Like Myra. So it was a story about a Myra who is getting married, living abroad, doing all the fun things that her friends can only dream of. And so she was getting married, and they were going to be her bridesmaid again. And it's a story about them thinking about what it's like now to be 60 plus. So I wrote a 25-minute play, produced it, and I thought, okay, now I'm going to do the long version, the full version. And as I wrote, I was envious of these BFFs, these girlfriends who had, you know, they had each other. And
your characters, you were envious of your own characters that you had created.
Absolutely, and there I was in the corner trying to get this full play out. And I stopped, and a friend, we got together, we started telling stories, and I thought, this is what I would like to do. Women over 50 meet. At first it was every month. And what we do is every other month is a larger group. Every month, a reduced size group meets. Very supportive group, 5-minute stories, about 10 storytellers. We limit the gathering to no more than 60 because there's no mics. So usually about 40 to 60. And it's wonderful. It's a great sisterhood.
So either I move into Austin or you move into Houston and start a Story Sisters here.
Let's do it.
All right.
Let's do it.
All right.
You know, at the Moth, I was just blown away by so many women over 50. That is so exciting.
This last Moth was exciting, with women talking, speaking to the Me Too movement, which your panty raid story reminded me of. No wonder we had so many problems back then. And I do remember in the 70s, the Fijis used to come over and dance naked at my dorm. They didn't ask for panties, they just danced naked.
So that was my problem. I married a Fiji.
Oh, you did? Oh my God. I get it now. It all comes together.
So just for clarification, when they say silk, did you have to throw silk? Could you throw cotton?
Oh, we threw whatever we had. And, okay. You know, and some of them, you know, really, I'm so embarrassed. You know, we were so naive. So some of them were those horrible white cotton full briefs that grandmas wear.
Yeah.
You know that the boys didn't want to catch those. They wanted something that was silky with lace.
Okay. So, guys, I just let you in on a little bit of the really enjoyable fun that we had at dinner tonight. Just a taste of it. StorySisters.com. Look at it in Austin. Let's think about it in Houston. So, just talking about, March Madness, COVID-19 Madness. We've just gone on several exciting, poignant, and plot-twisting journeys now. As I mentioned earlier in the show, we know that our March has been upended, so we wanted to bring humor to the evening tonight. That's one part of the journey we wanted to take everybody on, something to really lighten our mood. And I talked to Hank Rubicek, our producer, and I said, what do you think is the funniest story from our archive? And he came up with one that I think is absolutely hilarious. So I'm going to hand it over to you, Hank, now.
Thank you. Now, it's not the funniest story. It's not the funniest story.
It looked pretty good to me.
It's pretty funny, but it is, let's just say it's a humorous story with a very poignant message. I thought that would fit in really well.
Perfect.
But you know what? I got to tell you, over 50, huh? The three of you ought to be in a liar's contest. That's all. I just wanted to point that out.
Oh, are you trying to compliment us?
Yeah, I'm just saying, yeah, right. Over 50. A while back. No, I tried. All right, okay. Only kidding. Yeah, right.
Are you trying to uncompliment us?
Give me a break. But you're beautiful women, regardless of age. I just wanted everybody to know that.
Thank you.
And that's the truth.
Thank you.
Now, yeah, this particular story, Mary, I really appreciate this opportunity. I found it really in a mountain of humorous ones. And I think this one is special. It's by Rabbi Laura Sheinkopf, and it was given, she delivered this in the studio in 2014, and it's about officiating at a drag queen ceremony. I'll just leave it at that. Justin?
Several years back, I was asked by an acquaintance who's a wedding planner to give an opening prayer for a meeting of an organization that raises money for worthy causes, and it's an organization of drag queens. It's a national organization. And they asked if I could come and do the opening benediction for their meeting because he was being installed on the board. And I have to tell you, under normal circumstances, coming from, let's see, you know, I grew up on Cape Cod. I went to school in New York. I'm obviously very well connected in the arts and in the world. Drag queens are, you know, it's not a big deal to me. So I would have normally said yes, but I had just recently separated from my husband, and it wasn't a good time. And I decided to step away from being a pulpit rabbi a few years before, and I really didn't have a place in the community, and I was feeling rather bad about myself, but I said okay. And then he said, yeah, we figured you wouldn't have anything going on because it's Valentine's Day. That kind of hurt, but I pretended that he meant because it is a Saint Valentine, but I think he was meaning something about me being single. So we just overlooked that, and I went down, and of course I couldn't even find him because everyone was in drag. And I was exceptionally unexceptional in that crowd, very small. And I understand how to perform, so I tried to conceal it. But it was a really tough time for me. And I felt somehow shut out of my own community, even though that was in my head, I think. So all that kept going through my head was that line from Angels in America where he says, you know, things are bad when even drag is a drag. And that's kind of how I felt. So I got down there, and they called me up to give my benediction. It's a crowded bar. Everyone's in drag. Very noisy. When you speak at a synagogue or a church, there's always someone clanking around in the kitchen or people talking in the back. The microphone pops, right? Not these guys. They had the microphone set up to me beautifully, modulated already for my voice, and a pink lighting to make me look better. And I got up there and opened my mouth, and it was like the seas parted. Like, you could have heard a pin drop. And I don't even remember exactly what I said. I actually talked about the reason I named this story, It's Where You Stand, is because I actually referenced a part of Genesis where Adam has eaten an apple, right? And he suddenly is ashamed, and he goes hiding from God, which is strange, right? And God says, Adam, where are you? Which is also strange because it's one garden, one man. Why would God not be able to find this person, right? Yeah. And so the rabbis say he really wasn't asking, where are you? He was asking, who are you? And that's why eventually what Adam had to say was, Hineni, here I am. Hineni is not the same in Hebrew as saying, Ani po, I'm just here. It's an existential, a deeply felt acknowledgement of where you are in life and why that makes you who you are. And so I said something like that. And, I mean, I just remember seeing tears in the eyes. I remember seeing the false eyelashes, being very impressed with those and how moved they were. And it was an incredibly important moment for me because it made me realize that, first of all, it took me out of myself. It also showed me, again, the power of sharing yourself and your story, even if I wasn't doing it explicitly. But putting myself out there, right? That is how we expand in the world. It is not by contracting. And I felt that was a tremendous gift to me. So I go down there as much as possible because they know how to raise money too. They're very entertaining. It was like a more valuable religious experience than almost anything I had done up until that point.
So, guys, everybody, I have to tell you that I went to a benefit brunch for the Catastrophic Theater Group, and they had a raffle, and I won a ticket to get a drag queen makeover.
Yay!
With a photographic session. And I almost threatened to do it just before a family wedding, but I figured I would never be invited back again to any family gathering. But it's coming, and I will make sure you'll all get to see the pictures. Hank, we have just a couple more minutes
okay.
left, and
all
we're
right,
enjoying
all right, all right.
this
yeah.
uplifting
yeah,
and, journey through uplifting
and,
fun stories.
And
this
as
time.
I said, that was not it's not the funniest story. That she is a really funny lady, but it's not so much that it was funny. It's just it's the random moments that we experience that are just incredibly humorous. Frankly, Mel Brooks said it best. He said, "You know what? Laughter is our defense against the universe," right?
Absolutely.
Speaking of that, now that I'll give myself a segue, I always tell the entire story, but I'm going to give just a 90-second version about the way our society is changing in terms of learning. I'll just leave it at that. Two summers ago, I'm teaching summer school, and I'm running some errands on a Friday before classes begin on Monday, right? So I walk into the Starbucks right up the street from where we live, and it's really early, and I'm the only one there. Now, this is important for everyone to understand. I was the only one there. No one was there with their phones, their laptops. There were a couple of, baristas in there getting ready to make the coffee, but I was it, and I'm in line. And I place my order. I'd like a tall, non-fat vanilla latte. And the young man behind the register asks, "What is your name?" I said, "Why? I'm the only one here." He says, "Well, it's what we do." I said, "Okay, Mick Jagger." And he looks at me seriously and he says, "We only need the first name." I said, "Okay, Mick." He writes it out. I can't believe what I'm seeing. And a few minutes later, a young lady, calls out my name. I'm still the only one there. And she screams like it's crowded, right? She screams, "Mick!" I'm right here. Okay, so I thought that was an interesting event. But then a few minutes later, I'm at my allergist's office. This is errand day. And I come out of the allergist, and the office manager says, "Oh, Dr. Rubichek, you need to come in 6 months from now." Now, this is June. And she says, looks at her calendar, and she says, "That would be December 7th. And I break out into my FDR imitation. "Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy." And she looks at me and says, "Did you just make that up?" So there's a lot more to this story, but suffice it to say that I realized that maybe I wasn't the greatest teacher in the world, but somebody's got to be. I don't know. It was just very interesting. I remember the days when there's no possible way people would not know the answers to those questions. But in any event, I'll leave that as a little piece of humor for the night. So in the meantime, everybody, know the Declaration of War in Japan speech, and please know, I am not Mick Jagger.
He makes a pretty good Mick. Hey, everybody, I hope that our show tonight has been able to lighten your mood a little bit as we've been going through what I call our upended March Madness. But don't you dare move, because we have a new and exciting show following us. Coming up next, you'll be loving Lars Tennyson's Tape Deck. Music making poetry, or poetry making music. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. I'm Dr. E, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.